So many ways to say I love you in different languages across the land. You haven't heard them all, so I'll tell you as only a true geek can.
Hello, and welcome to the post-plague edition of Geekfully Yoked.
We are a house of death.
We are a recovering house of death. As always, I'm Lehman Kessler.
And I'm Rachel Kessler.
That's Mother Rachel Kessler.
I am a priest here in the Anglican Diocese of Toronto, and I got to spend Tuesday evening in the emergency room.
And I role-play as a conniving mouse over Facebook, and I got to also spend that evening with her. How are you doing, Rachel?
I had the plague.
Yes, and then you gave the plague to me.
Yes, but you had like the shadow plague. I sympathize for your sufferings, but it was like the merest.
Was it like a bad like sequel to your plague?
I think so.
Like the low budget, like straight to VHS Disney movie version of the plague. Okay, I'm willing to accept that.
I do not believe that you have yet vomited.
No. Not yet. That is
Thank
true.
Thank you, Internet, for, you know.
We like,
that
well, we
us.
Just we want to be open with you. The first thing we need to do, aside from letting you know about our various dietary mismanagements,
gastrointestinal issues,
is issue a retraction and apology. Last time we talked about our viewings of Deep Space Nine, and we mentioned how one of our friends had certain opinions regarding the shipper status of Dukat and Kira, and we accidentally attributed it to Randy when really it belongs to one Dr. Andrew Reeves. Dr. Andrew Reeves.
He is a deviant figure, if ever there was one.
It's very true. Let us have the record made clean. We have continued to move on in our Deep Space Nine viewings, although we paused a little bit during this plague week.
It's true. But we did finally watch Cabin in the Woods, because when you're laid up on a couch having your insides
churning?
I was going to try to go some image of feeling as though your body is being turned inside out.
Okay. What you want to do is watch a Joss Whedon meta horror film?
Clearly.
What were your takeaway feelings about Cabin in the Woods, Rachel?
It made me realize that I am of much sterner stuff than I was even a few years ago.
Yeah,
that movie would have, like, absolutely freaked me out.
There was a lot less pillow grabbing, like, this time
very
around.
Very strange. I've become a jaded and hardened person.
I feel like you were more distraught and upset when we watched Extras than when we watched this movie.
It's the personal angst of Extras that I can't deal with, that I find, it, you know...
People getting their heads chopped off, well, that's just, you know, a matter of business.
Well, physical pain is one thing, and emotional pain is a whole different kind of suffering. It was certainly the most meta thing in the entire world, but I quite enjoyed it.
I liked it.
It was funny, it was clever, it was an interesting commentary that implicated not only everyone in the entire film, but also the viewer.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, because I think... Watching it, I realized that it was doing what I originally thought Hostel was doing. Like, I thought Hostel was making
some... Yeah, I remember that you were all, like, defending Hostel, like...
I thought Hostel was making this interesting, like, meta point about, like, the voyeurism of horror films and, like, how we all participate in this, like, horrible thing.
What finally deluded you of that?
The fact that there were, like, 8 sequels. And I was like, oh, nope, it's just the thing itself.
Torture porn?
And this movie, I mean, I think it did the thing that Shaun of the Dead did, which was be an interesting quasi-parody of itself while still being a really good example of the thing that it's commenting on. Like, the scary moments, even though they were oddly undercut, were still pretty scary.
Well, I don't really want to get into...
No.
Yeah, we shouldn't get into spoiler territory, but I was impressed... Based on what I'd seen in the trailers, I thought that it was all just... I didn't think there was going to be real horror to it. And there was actually real supernatural horror, which
Well, and they couched it interestingly, but it didn't detract. And I think that's, I mean, largely because regular horror is so camp and not particularly scary. I mean, yeah. Regular horror itself is really, I mean, I could go into a huge spiel about it because there was a period of time when I worked at Blockbuster when I watched tons and tons and tons and tons of horror movies and, like, came to this idea that horror sat in this this intersection of fantasy and sci-fi and drama and comedy and action and blah, 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 blah. And I work at Blockbuster and I'm very lonely. But we're not here to talk about my time in Blockbuster. We're here to talk about the years preceding that. That's right.
90s?
It's time to go back to the 90s.
I just had a weird desire to sing the theme song from Clarissa Explains It All, which we probably cannot do for copyright reasons.
I was going to make a Zach Morris reference. I like how Clarissa Explains It All essentially just morphed seamlessly into Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Like, there's really no difference.
Yeah, it's very true.
There's a cat puppet, and that's really it.
The cat puppet was pretty awesome.
Salem's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But what we're going to discuss today is the parallel cultures that exist. And they have existed for decades. But I think they were particularly heightened for us in the 90s. And that is 90s popular culture and 90s Christian culture. Because for certain evangelical crowds, popular culture, you know, mainstream movies and television and music are anathema. And that's you know, mainstream society trying to infect you with its sinful mores. And so you need to only
create your strange alternative culture?
Yes. And it becomes problematic because it becomes a captive audience. Like, so it doesn't have to be very good. You know, like, you in Nashville, there was always the joke that, you know, most of the Christian performance artists and musicians essentially got there by failing at being a regular, like, rock star or, like, trying to go into country music and, like, having a few unsuccessful years. And so they're like, well, I might as well go into Christian music, and then you could have a decent career because grandmothers and aunts could be like, oh, look, a new Christian album. I can buy that for my poor child. So this leads to some bizarre parallels, like, because they do oddly mirror one another.
Well, because when I was a kid, it was always reading Brio magazine.
Oh, right.
I know. That could be, we could have a whole conversation about that later on. And your college roommate, our good buddy Tom, became weirdly obsessed with my Brio magazines when they were still mailed to me in university for inexplicable reasons.
It's very, very true.
But they would always run these articles on, so for those of you who don't know, Brio was the, this actually leads into this, because Brio was the 17 magazine for Christian girls.
Yes.
And why my parents thought that I, of all people, needed to be reading a, like, teeny bopper, this proves my point. Okay, so every issue of the magazine, there would be the, like, if you like this secular group, you'd love this Christian group.
Oh, right.
And I'm like, but I don't like that music anyway, so why would I want to listen to this group? But so it's the similar thing, like, if you would read 17 magazine, you should be reading Brio magazine.
Yeah,
it was the I wasn't going to be reading 17 magazine because I was a giant nerd.
Yeah, they didn't sort of have, if you like Star Trek, you'll like Dr. Quinn Medicine Woman? I don't know.
I watched a lot of Dr. Quinn Medicine
Woman. Well, see, I think, like, it's interesting because there are these things that, like, straddle the line, right?
Well, it's the stuff that you could get away with. So, for some, growing up in the evangelical South, right, all secular music was absolutely anathema, except for country music.
Oh,
country music
darn.
Was okay.
Yeah.
Because despite all of the adultery and despite all of the drinking and despite all of the sex, they would occasionally talk about God.
And
how much they loved America, yes.
No, it's very true. I found that deeply disconcerting.
But for me, being such a, I mean, I guess we're getting a little off topic here and we'll go back to the, but the sci-fi culture kind of fell under the radar.
There was Bible Man.
But, I mean, for the most part, there was not Christian science. I guess there was Stephen Lawhead. But there wasn't, at least in the circles that I was in.
Yeah.
The geeky stuff was already such its own subculture.
Yeah.
That I was able to get away with a lot of that in ways that, it's kind of strange, except that there was also a lot of it that my parents were really against.
Well, any of, like, I know the Harry Potter stuff. And
yeah, but Harry Potter was even a little bit later.
That's true.
But Buffy.
Oh, right.
I was, you know, not allowed to watch Buffy.
Because there were witches and whatnot.
Well, you know, my mom would see commercials for it while she was watching Seventh Heaven. And,
oh, Seventh Heaven.
Yeah. And see it as demonic. And so I was not allowed to watch that. So that was a great transgression when I got to university and started watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Corrupted by our Catholic friend yet again.
Corrupted by our Catholic friend yet again. And, you know, any kind of role-playing.
Yeah.
Any kind of role-playing game was just...
I mean, I think of the sort of the anti-D&D crusades as being more 80s based. But I guess, like, the sort of the repercussions and, like, reverberations of that continued on. Like... It's interesting. Growing up in a missionary family household, I did not have a particularly strict upbringing as far as things that were sort of forbidden me and whatnot, and especially not like sci-fi stuff or gaming stuff.
Yeah.
I think my mother talked about how like she viewed my brothers playing these things as keeping them off the street. Like, the stuff that was frowned upon, I remember, was Married with Children, and for a while, The Simpsons...
Oh, The Simpsons was very bad.
Until my mother saw an episode with Ned Flanders and was really happy that there was a positive Christian role model. I've mentioned before that my parents are very earnest and sometimes don't get irony. But I want to talk... So I want to start talking about television, because I think that's a very good sort of starting off point. And looking at, like, what the 90s television
had. Do you actually have notes?
I have notes. I have notes.
Good.
And one thing I want to discuss...
I think you're just totally making this up as we went along.
I sometimes plan.
Excellent.
I want to talk about the do-gooder shows.
Oh.
Now, the do-gooder shows have existed for a while, but I feel like they came to a head in the 90s, and we really haven't seen
except for Leverage.
Leverage and Burn Notice, I think, are the two
examples. I watch
examples.
Leverage and forget that it isn't made in the 90s.
So, there's a type of TV show, and I think it's if you think about, like, Stairway to Heaven, or if you think about Quantum Leap, and, you know, a show where, like, it's an episodic show with a main hero whose job is just to, like, solve some problem in a... sort of hackneyed way.
Touched by an Angel.
And again, the 90s just had these shows in spades. Touched by an Angel, Early Edition, The Pretender, Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. I mean, even to some degree, I mean, you could think about like the Next Generations and stuff like that. But there was sort of this very earnest quality to them. There was very little irony. And watching on Netflix, a bunch of these shows have like suddenly been sort of unlocked, you know? And going back and watching it is just like, really? People were, like, buying this sort of, like, level of schmaltz? Oh, okay. And there would be, like, sarcastic characters, but not, like, the level of cynicism I sort of expect in a, like, post-9/11 world. Where I was in the South, we had the PAX network. I didn't have...
Oh, I remember PAX!
I didn't have cable, so we had, you know, just our basic, like, ABC, NBC, Fox, WB, and UPN, although I think those have all been, like, merged into their own weird networks now. But then we also had PAX, eventually, and PAX was, like, I think it was, like, meant to be a Christian network. I'm not 100% sure.
I think it was, like, faith,
but that's where, like, that's where, like, the Seventh Heavens would, like, go for reruns, and where I'm pretty sure they showed, like, Dr. Quinn, and I don't know if it still exists, but if it did, that's where the strange, like, movies made by Kirk Cameron would go now. Although, we just saw on Netflix a movie about Hosea starring Sean Astin. Sean Astin is trying to get in on that Christian money. I'm so proud of him in a weird way. Like, other than that, like, I mean, if you look at, like, sort of Christian, like, responses and things like that, we had VeggieTales. And I think, like, VeggieTales...
was the most awesome thing in the entire
world.
I
wonder if it, like, it filled the weird, like, dork gap. Like, it was sort of strange and weird and, like, just, like, unapologetically silly, but still had, like, a weird level of quality about it so that, you know... dorky Christian teenagers like us could kind of, like, jump on board.
I feel like there is a feral beast that wants into our home.
We should probably let him in.
Yes.
So we had VeggieTales, and I'm trying to think of, like, other examples of, like, sort of Christian... I mean, I think, like, there was a lot more Christian movies and, like, videos and things that they would show. You know, like, youth group sort of, like... Because, again, there was, aside from PAX, there really wasn't, like, a Christian, like, TV network.
No. I just remember bad youth group musicals.
Bad youth group musicals?
Did you never have to be in a bad youth group musical?
I remember
seeing... with some kind of, like, Christian message?
Well, I didn't go on the fun, like, missionary trips you did off to save the Roman Catholics.
Yeah, we can talk about that later. That could be a whole another episode.
No, I remember seeing one of my churches, like, do Godspell, which is a good musical.
for that. That was made by liberal hippies.
From Toronto.
Oh, my goodness.
I know.
You went to much more interesting churches than I did.
I went to a Methodist church.
Okay. That explains.
No, we didn't. We had like weird puppet shows, I remember. And I think we would do like strange like Christian versions of songs. Like I think we did He's Some Kind of Wonderful. They're like, "Can I get a witness?" And it's supposed to be about like a guy singing about a girl. But we changed it to being about Jesus.
So of course. Like, well, that was classic. That's, like, that's how
Jesus
you did all
is some
the songs.
Kind of wonderful, talking about my
Didn't
Jesus.
Were you at some camp with Jesus last for so long,
yes.
even after you're gone?
So, if you want to see, like, the worst example of parallel Christian just plagiarism, I was at either a Centrifuge or...
Centrifuge.
Or whatever that work program was.
Got to be a... World changer.
World changer. It was
For those of you who cannot see, I'm actually doing the hand motions.
She is doing the hand gestures. It's very true. It was one of the two, and a girl got up on stage and literally sang Jules' Dreams Last for So Long, except she replaced the word dreams with Jesus. So she would just sing like a regular verse, you know, "I know you hate it when I leave the light on," and then get to "Jesus lasts for so long."
Wow. Jewel was very 90s.
It made it seem like Jesus would be mad that you left the toothpaste cap on. It was very disconcerting.
Well, it's very inappropriate to do that. I'm sure it does make Jesus very upset.
Oh, gosh darn. It was so strange. This was possibly the same girl that, like, I noticed had, like, carved a cross into her, like, leg. So, you know.
Well, so this brings us to the... creepy aspects of Christian culture versus the creepy aspects of
90s culture.
Like 90s culture.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, it's the parallels, I think, can really be seen in music, right?
Mm.
Like, that's the real captive audience.
Yeah.
Like, luckily, I was not forbidden secular music, but that made sort of Christian music almost like more fun for me because I was able to like explore it almost like a tourist.
Right.
So, you know, I would be exposed to, you know, a random W song at youth group or at Centrifuge.
Man, I liked the W's. I was definitely into the whole Christian ska. What was up with Christian ska?
Yeah, what was up with Christian ska?
I don't know, but that was like the genre that like completely passed over the secular culture.
Well, no, there was ska. Ska kids was a thing.
Yeah, it was, but like for like a week.
Well,
but
you know.
Christian ska just went crazy.
See, I only know the W's.
Well, and the Supertones were the other one.
Oh, should we go find your old CD collection, Rachel?
Oh, let's not. Let's not.
I once, during a modern-day like Bible study, pulled out one of Rachel's old... like,
I think it was a praise and worship
praise CD. Praise and worship CD, and played it as people entered, and they were very confused.
This was at a very, like...
high church.
High Anglo-Catholic, singing Anglican chant and Hail Marys.
Instead, they're getting, like, soft guitar music from the 90s. So the other groups that we got to deal with that I were more familiar with, Newsboys.
Oh, yeah.
Which
were they the ones that had the like, spinning drum kit in some of their videos?
I think so.
That went upside down?
I believe so. But they were very famous for their "Shine, Make 'em Wonder What You Got." And, of course, "Breakfast in Hell."
Which you karaoke
which I
in
found
front
out.
Of our crazy Anglo-Catholic priest
who
was horrified. It was amazing.
A karaoke place that I went to, I suddenly realized had all these Newsboys songs as a part of their like repertoire, and I was in heaven. And it was the best because I would like sing a song and get like blank looks from like 80 people, and then there'd be like one girl being like, "I know that song." It was pretty amazing. But the one band that I feel
Bilbo was very famous.
Which it did straddle because they did get major airplay was DC Talk. And DC Talk was sort of a bizarre, like, kind of rock, kind of rap.
They were that weird, like, I hate saying this, but they were that weird kind of, like, early 90s white boy rap.
Yeah, except they were, like, mid to late 90s, so.
No, I think they got started by, because I was listening to them when I was at day camp in, grade 5.
Oh, all right.
I just said grade 5, I'm such a comedian.
You are, you're a traitor.
So, I mean, they've been around for a while before even the late 90s.
Okay. All right. I think it was around, like, maybe 98 when they started getting, like, that one song that didn't mention Jesus, but I think it was about Jesus.
Yeah.
Sort of like that Vertical Horizon song.
Oh, okay.
Vertical Horizon, I did not know was Christian. I was sort of more disappointed when I found out that they were. What was the other? Creed. I think Creed was the other, like, strange kind of crossover band.
But yeah, DC Talk was very,
But they're very, well, they're very earnest, right? I mean, that's the thing. That's, I mean, I think earnestness can, like, be.
But it was the 90s when we did earnestness really well.
Yeah, well, we just did so much of it. Like, looking, I'm trying to, like, you know, looking back on, like, old TV and stuff like that, it for some reason, just the 90s have this, like, almost, like, swell attitude about
when
things.
When I go back to watch my episodes of Lois and Clark, which is, like, my 90s guilty pleasure.
Yeah.
Like that. It's almost painful to watch.
Lois and Clark is pretty painful. Mountie Show's done all right. Do South?
Well, the Mountie Show was okay. All right, so for those listening in south of the border, even though this was an American-Canadian production, no one in America...
Filmed in Toronto, set in Chicago.
Set in Chicago. No one in America knows this show. The DVDs in the States are like $15 a season, and the DVDs in Canada are like $80 a season. this was a show about a Mountie who goes to Chicago on the trail of his father's killer, as he says in every episode in the fourth season, to track down his father's killer, and then stays attached as a liaison to the Canadian consulate.
For reasons that make sense.
For reasons of plot. He has a deaf, lip-reading wolf named Diefenbaker, named after former Canadian Prime Minister John Diefenbaker. And occasionally Leslie Nielsen appears on this show, and he sort of gets like weirdly paired up with a rough talking Chicago detective, and they have strange adventures because he's just so darn polite and Canadian.
He is very polite. And yeah,
I think why, I mean, it's the typical Canadian, like, 90s do-gooder show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so ridiculously earnest, and every... I think there are some episodes that feature upwards of 3 musical montages. but I think what made it work was that it just, at some point, got so surreal and so, like, bizarrely self-referential and commenting on itself, and eventually it just got... Like, it starts off as a fairly earnest, straight-up show. I think originally created by the guy who produced the movie Crash.
Oh, okay.
A few years ago, but then, by the you know, later into the second season and into the third and fourth seasons, it just becomes completely surreal.
Yeah.
Where he has the ghost of his dead father, played by Canadian icon Gordon Pinchot.
Yes.
Who lives in his closet in the Canadian consulate, and the closet is like an Arctic lodge. And then they change the actor who plays his buddy cop.
That's right. They got Callum Keith
Rennie. They did. They got a Cylon.
They did.
And they just... actually make reference to the fact that it's a different actor, but it's the same character.
Like they do like a 5 minutes of like acknowledgement, and then they sort of move on. And it's very strange because even Paul Gross, who plays the Mountie, I've been watching him on this Canadian program called Slings and Arrows, which is all about like sort of professional, you know, theater companies, and it's incredibly like dark and snarky and exactly what I like expect a modern television show to be. And so to see this like very 90s guy in this very modern setting is so like disconcerting. It's like you're swearing and being mean to people and not just like tackling bad guys and like being polite to them as you're tackling them. So yeah, earnestness I think is key.
But the funny thing about Due South was that it was almost a commentary on that. Like,
yeah,
it was a 90s cop show. It did have all kinds of musical montages. It was ridiculously earnest, but at the same time, there was a weird commentary on the earnestness.
Yeah, okay, I can see that.
So which is part of why I find it delightful. And
well, and we watched
wonderful.
It in 2 very different settings, because I actually watched it when it was running during the 90s, and so I mostly just remember it from the 90s.
Yeah.
And you started watching it like only like a couple of years ago, like 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
So
as
I have to imagine...
As part of my enculturation to Canadiana.
Yes. So I imagine, like, that has to be very different in terms of, like, how you look at something 10 years after it's been on. And a lot of TV... Again, that's sort of the weird thing about Netflix. We're going back and watching next-gen episodes, and we're sort of trying to, like... We're doing a kind of a two-pronged tactic. We're first hitting, like, the highlight, like, episodes I remember being, like, decent or, like, quasi-decent, memorable.
And whenever Lehman is pretty sure I'm going to fall asleep,
I put on episodes from, like, the first season. Like, stuff that I – because I either they didn't run in syndication that much or I just, like, somehow missed them. And, whew, oh, this show has not aged well. Oh, space Nigerians who want to steal their white women. Oh, it's bad news. So yeah, so that weird, like kind of almost innocence of the era, that's very, very different from, like, I don't know, 70s and 80s television, which, I don't know, like, had in some ways more bite than some of these 90s shows.
Well, watching soap, right?
Yeah.
We watch soap. I mean, Netflix is just, like, this journey into the past.
Precisely. Yeah, soap was very interesting because they were tackling some issues that I feel like wouldn't get tackled again for another, like, 20 years.
No, but it got very dark.
Yeah, very much so.
So what do you think? So what do you think caused this earnestness, innocence, aw shucksness of the 90s? Is it coming out of the 80s where things got so dark?
I have to imagine there's some weird, like, you know, post Cold War optimism.
Yeah.
Like, you know, yeah, post 80s, just whatever was going on.
I mean,
in the 80s.
There was the grunge movement in the 90s, but even grunge was kind of.
Well, again, yeah,
there was an artificiality.
It does, yeah, seem weirdly sort of sweet. No, it's hard for me to tell because the 90s I equate not just with, like, weird post-war stuff, but also the fact that I was coming to America and, like, and staying in America for, like, the first time. So, in weird ways, my own, like, popular cultural, like, education was happening, and I was slightly behind. Like, I was falling in love with Ace of Base and, like, the Spin Doctors, but at the same time discovering 80s music for the first time because I hadn't really been exposed to it. So, and then being going from, like, the missionary world, which is, like, weirdly kind of cut off, but, you know, like, I remember watching, like, The Terminator with my missionary friends, and I remember watching, like, Robin Hood and, you know, things like that, like, pretty dark movies, and then, like, being with, like, my Baptist youth group, which, you know, it seemed like, you know, oh, you know, we have to not be like the rest of the world, and you need to cut yourself off, and you need to, like...
I mean, I definitely grew up with this cut yourself off from the rest of the world,
yeah.
not be like, except for country music, don't be like the culture
yeah.
around you. Be of the world, in the world, well,
but
not of
the world,
and all of that. But how do you think this this optimism, innocence, almost too innocent earnestness
yeah.
of the 90s is reflected in 90s Christian culture? Because it's interesting, like, not being really part of evangelical circles now, I can't comment on
that's what I was thinking. Like,
what?
I was trying to figure out if it's changed.
Yeah.
Like, the only thing I can really think of in recent years that's, like, been super memorable Christian-wise are, well, the weird, like, movies that, like, Kirk Cameron, like,
yeah.
movies and the stuff coming out of that church. The Fireproof mm. and the, like, Facing the Giants, which does have this weird, like, almost, like, 90s earnestness about it.
Yeah.
But also, like, things like Give Me That Christian Side Hug, you know?
Well, I mean, there's Christian hipster culture,
I haven't begun to understand that.
Know a little bit about it from seminary, because
yeah.
those were all of, my seminary had a international development
yeah.
master's, as well as sort of normal master's of divinity stream, and a lot of those people were, like, you know, going out and working for NGOs, and definitely
yeah.
the Christian hipster type, and so I kind of get that aspect of, like, trying to make Christianity cool, and that idea of redeeming culture rather than separating from culture. But I don't know what Christian youth groups are like today necessarily, and I don't know what... So I can't really speak to that, but it's interesting to wonder how much of sort of the cheesy aspects that we equate with Christian culture from our childhood, teenage years, it reflects kind of the cheesiness of the culture of its time as well. So I'm thinking about, like, what would Jesus do bracelets?
Versus, I mean, snap bracelets?
Well, what would Jesus do bracelets were kind of cheesy.
Yes,
and,
they were.
And they were overly simplistic. And, you know, it got to a point where, I mean, at least in the culture that we were living in, which were, you know, really predominantly evangelical Southern culture, everyone had a what would Jesus do bracelet.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of the what would Jesus do. I also think of things like the sort of meet you at the pole felt very, like,
yeah.
aggressive in the 90s.
But just, again, not even aggressive, but just so earnest.
Well, yeah.
Again, that lack of self-reflection. Mm. And I think, I guess what I'm trying to get at is I feel like our society today has become so, so I mean, this goes into Cabin in the Woods, right? Everything is meta. Everything is a commentary.
Well, you know, everything is very self-aware.
And so my, what exposure I do have of kind of evangelical culture or sort of youth-oriented evangelical culture is very much this idea of Christian hipsterdom,
yeah.
which is this idea of Christianity which is laced with irony and self-awareness and self-referentiality, which does kind of lack that earnestness which we associate, which I associate with the Christian culture I experienced as
well, a child. And sort of mainstream hipsterdom is all about like a weird rejection of pop culture. So in a weird way, yeah. there's like, it's been co-opted, so to like, you know, to reject pop culture is now sort of a hipsterish thing to do. So yeah. I guess to be like a Christian hipster is to sort of weirdly buy into that, or do you like reject the sort of the hipster idea
yeah.
and then like try to like find as much earnestness? It's very strange. I can't really keep track. I think it would be exhausting to be a teenager these days. I imagine teenagers, Christian and non, just spend a lot of time playing Minecraft.
So what is the overlap between sort of Christian culture setting up this weird subculture that is in some ways a rejection of the mainstream, and geek culture, which has its own kind of subculture and a rejection of things that are sort of
mainstream?
Because, I mean, there is that aspect to geek culture.
Yeah, no,
there is that kind of...
There can be a snobbishness
yeah,
about it.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think it's, you know, a need to define yourself
mm-hmm.
is a big part of it. A need to kind of set yourself apart, and you find these weird, like, little communities. And, we've talked about this before. I mean, I was essentially born a geek. Like, I was born into the most geek prime household with, you know, 2 10-year-old brothers, play Dungeons and Dragons, you know, parents who were very, like, book happy and just pop culture, you know, like, so... There are weird overlaps, I feel. Like, I feel like you don't have to completely, like, reject popular culture for geek culture. I think all of it really has become very nostalgia-based. I mean, if you think about, like, things like Family Guy, you know, or Community, I mean, like, so much of our culture is about throwing back to... You know, I mean, that's what this episode is, essentially. It's a throwback to, you know, the strangenesses of you know, younger times. And I wonder... That seems to be like across the board. Now I don't know if there's
related to that. I didn't get to ever talk about my time at the Toronto Comic Con meeting the cast of Star Trek: The Next Generation, and at the Q&A panel with LeVar Burton, we got to sing the Reading Rainbow theme song.
Oh,
led by LeVar Burton.
Now that is like prime earnestness,
like super earnestness, and it was kind of awesome.
Like it's hard to feel cynical about Reading Rainbow. It really is, especially with LeVar Burton.
I know.
But, you know, it's a question of, I don't know if, like, Christian culture has that same level of nostalgia. Like, I don't know if there's, like, folks out there getting Mark Lowry tattoos, you know? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know if, you know, people are really going to look back in 10, 20 years and be, like, all fired up about Kirk Cameron and how the banana disproved evolution, you know? Like, I feel like Christian culture just kind of moves on.
Well, and I think part of it, I mean, I think there is something to, I mean, this is the somewhat theological point to make out of all of this, is I do think from a Christian perspective, that tendency to reject culture and to try to create something that is
artificial,
untainted.
Yeah, oh, well, yeah.
Create something that's artificial and create something that is less than. I mean,
yeah.
That's what Christian music is, very often.
Mm-hmm.
It is less than whatever the
secular counterpart
is. Well,
yeah, there's less competition, it's a weird...
Christian literature is often less than. I'm not saying it all is, but I'm just saying very often we settle for something less. I mean, Dorothy Sayers has wonderful essays about Christian art and how it's usually so bland because it's moralistic, it's preachy, it's, you know... Whatever. And I think very often we sell ourselves and our creativity short.
Yeah.
Right? And I think something like The Lord of the Rings is a wonderful example of creativity, of a wonderful work of literature, something
yeah.
that defined a genre, which is fully informed by J.R.R. Tolkien's faith, but not... but not constricted by it.
Yeah, and I think that, and it's not this sort of active, like, aggressive sort of act of, you know, we need to save the world by making this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's you know, because you're cutting yourself out of the kind of the mainstream of imagination and creativity, you're not participating in that conversation, I think you're obviously going to be, you know, less than, because A, you're suspicious of what's come before, and B, you know, you've limited yourself to a sort of a narrow pool of other folks to kind of converse with and to talk with, and you wind up with Brio and Carmen.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, for me, part of the intersection of faith and fandom is that...
Superbooks?
No. is that idea of expressing creativity, of expressing, you know, something that is extraordinary.
Yeah.
Right? And sort of seeing what the limits of human imagination are, human creativity. I mean, that's all... That is part of my worldview, which is informed by my faith.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, what I find frustrating is denial of curiosity and denial of wonder. You know, like, and
wonder, right? Wonder is the really big thing.
And wonderment is a big part of, you know, my faith. You know, and not rejecting strangeness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's the thing that comforts me most about, you know, Christianity and the Bible and everything, is just how weird it is and how, you know, utterly, you know, it's not designed to provide easy answers.
No.
And I like that. I like that when folks honestly engage with the work and see what's troubling about it and don't try to kind of compartmentalize it and make it a sort of bunch of pat answers to turn it into something that would fit on the PAX network.
Indeed.
A final thought I had, and it was a King of the Hill episode that was really good. There was a hip youth leader that sort of like rolled into town, and it was all like, you know, kind of crazy 90s, like, you know, tattoos, like, you know, like
skateboarding,
like, you know, John 3:16 tattoos, long hair. It's like, hey man, we're not going to be the button up, like, suit and tie, like, Christianity of your, like, your grandpa's age. And Bobby was really like jumping on board that and thinking it was amazing, thinking it was the best thing ever. And at the end of it, Hank Hill gave this amazing speech where he pulled out an old box of Bobby's toys, and there was like a troll doll and like a Tamagotchi and like a bunch of just like really just, you know, like sad little like toys from like the early 90s. And Bobby was like, oh man, like, I can't believe I was ever into this. Like, oh, it's ridiculous. And Hank Hill said, I don't want you to turn your faith into a fad. I don't want you, Jesus, to wind up in this box. And I think that's the ultimate problem when people try to sort of parallel culture or create culture or try to, like, you know, hip up Jesus and hip up, like, you know, like kind of the, like, the weird teenage Bibles that kind of come out and things like that, you know, by simply allowing these things to exist organically, allowing Christian art to develop, you know, alongside regular culture. So you wind up with a C.S. Lewis, or you wind up with Madeleine L'Engle. You know, like,
dude, you need to read Madeleine L'Engle if you haven't before, because she's awesome.
This is a PSA from Rachel.
I'm just saying, is all. Underrated.
So I think that covers pretty much our various thoughts about the 90s and what they have to offer, or possibly not offer. Next time we're going to have to discuss our various post-con reports.
Indeed.
I hope everyone has a wonderful Easter.
Right, Holy Week. That's why I'm so tired today.
Yeah, that thing that, you know.
Sunday.
Yeah. I got to be Jesus. Good Friday, I get to be Pilate.
That's less fun.
I think that's a demotion. That's okay. I'll take it. In the world of faith, family, and fandom, in no particular order,
have a dolorous Holy Week, and then you can have a happy Easter.
We hope your Lents have not been too onerous. Geek out, y'all!
Wanna Ryan, a Roaisha in Vulcan, and Klingon, it's Kapaha, which sort of sounds like a threat. Aijalau is Romulan, but not exactly canon, in case we make the fanboys upset.
Nikar Telegar, that awesome is Mandalorian, in another galaxy.